been elected to support. This was bad enough, but the worst offenses occurred during the election of 1800. Jefferson was guilty of the blackest calumny and foulest falsehoods during that bitter campaign. While affecting disinterest and detachment, he was secretly hiring scandalmongers like James Callender to libel Adams with outrageous charges. Adams was mentally deranged. Adams intended to have himself crowned as an American monarch. Adams planned to appoint John Quincy his successor to the presidency. "This, sir, I considered as a personal injury," Abigail observed, "the sword that cut the Gordian knot." It was richly ironic and wholly deserving that the infamous Callender had then turned on Jefferson and accused him of a sexual liaison with Sally Hemings, his household slave. "The serpent you cherished and warmed," she noted with satisfaction, "bit the hand that nourished him." And so, if there was any forgiving to be done, it would all happen on the Adams side. In the meantime, Jefferson was the one who needed to do some soul-searching. She concluded with one last verbal slap. "Faithful are the wounds of a friend." Throughout his extraordinarily vast correspondence, Jefferson never received another letter like this one. He had his detractors, to be sure, but Federalist critics tended to attack him in the public press, which he could and did dismiss as partisan propaganda. Abigail's accusations, on the other hand, were private and personal, came from someone whom he respected as an intimate friend, and went beyond mere matters of political partisanship to questions of honor and trust. His first instinct was to claim that both sides, Republicans and Federalists alike, had engaged in lies and distortions during the election of 1800, and that he had suffered equivalent calumnies and falsehoods along with Adams. This was completely true. He then went on to disclaim that any person who knew either of us could possibly believe that either meddled in that dirty work. In effect, he had no role whatsoever in promoting Callender's libels against Adams. This was a lie. "What those who wish to think amiss of me," Jefferson pleaded, "I have learnt to be perfectly indifferent. But with those like Abigail, where I know a mind to be ingenious and need only truth to set it to rights, I cannot be as passive." Abigail was having none of it. As she saw it, Jefferson's denials only offered further evidence of his duplicity. His complicity in behind-the-scenes political plotting was common knowledge. Abigail had initially resisted the obvious because, as she put it, "the heart is long, very long in receiving the convictions that is forced upon it by reason." Even now, she acknowledged, "affection still lingers in the bosom, even after esteem has taken its flight." But there was no denying that Jefferson had mortgaged his honor to win an election. His Federalist critics had always accused him of being a man of party rather than principle. "Pardon me, sir, if I say," Abigail concluded, "that I fear you are." We can be reasonably sure that Abigail was speaking for her husband as well as herself in this brief volley of letters. The Adams team, then, was charging Jefferson with two serious offenses against the unwritten code of political honor purportedly binding on the leadership class of the revolutionary generation. The first offense, which has a quaint and wholly anachronistic sound to our modern ears, was that Jefferson was personally involved in his own campaign for the presidency, and that he conducted that campaign with only one goal in mind, namely winning the election. This was the essence of the charge that he was a party man. Such behavior became an accepted, even expected, feature of the political landscape during the middle third of the 19th century, and has remained so ever since. Within the context of the revolutionary generation, however, giving one's allegiance to a political party remained illegitimate. It violated the core of virtue and disinterestedness presumed essential for anyone properly equipped to oversee public affairs. Neither Washington nor Adams had ever played a direct role in their own campaigns for office, and even Jefferson, who was the first president to break with that tradition, felt obliged to do so surreptitiously, then issue blanket denials when confronted by Abigail. Jefferson, in fact, was on record as making one of the strongest statements of the era against the influence of political parties. He described party allegiance as the last degradation of a free and moral agent, and claimed that if I could not go to heaven but with a party, I would not go there at all. Jefferson's position on political parties, like his stance on slavery, seemed to straddle a rather massive contradiction. In both instances, his posture of public probity, slavery should be ended, and political parties were evil agents that corrupted Republican values, was at odds with his personal behavior and political interest. And in both instances, Jefferson managed to convince himself that these apparent contradictions were, well, merely apparent. In the case of his active role behind the scenes during the presidential campaign of 1800, Jefferson sincerely believed that a Federalist victory meant the demise of the spirit of 76. Anything that avoided that horrible outcome ought to be justifiable. He then issued so many denials of his direct involvement in the campaign that he probably came to believe his own lies. That is why Abigail's relentless refusal to accept his personal testimonials on this score struck a nerve. He was not accustomed to having his word questioned and his excuses exposed, not even by himself. His second offense was more personal, namely, he had vilified a man whom he claimed was a long-standing friend. He had sponsored Callender's polemics against the Adams administration, even though he knew them to be gross misrepresentations. Adams had no monarchical ambitions, though he did believe in a strong executive. He did not want war with France, though he did think that American neutrality should take precedence over the Franco-American alliance. Both positions were in accord with Washington's preferred policy. Unlike Washington, however, Adams had political vulnerabilities which Jefferson exploited for his own political advantage. If the gross distortions had been orchestrated by Madison or any number of lesser political operatives, it would have been bad enough. But for Jefferson himself to have sanctioned the defamation was the essence of betrayal. It was akin to Hamilton's behind-the-scenes slandering of Burr, except in the case of Adams, the slander was more contemptible because essentially untrue. If Adams had been a believer in the Code Duello, which he was not, nor for that matter was Jefferson, this defamation of the Adams character would have presented a prime opportunity for a resolution with pistols on the field of honor. For at the highest level of political life in the early republic, relationships remained resolutely personal, dependent on mutual trust, and therefore vulnerable to betrayals whenever the public and private overlapped. Although Jefferson probably presumed that Abigail was sharing their correspondence with her husband, Adams himself never saw the letters until several months later. After reading over the exchange, he made this written comment for the record. "The whole of this correspondence was begun and conducted without my knowledge or suspicion, and this morning, at the desire of Mrs. Adams, I read the whole. I have no remarks to make upon it at this time and in this place. A steely silence thereupon settled over the dialogue between Quincy and Monticello for the following 8 years. During that time, Jefferson was too busy to indulge in retrospective fretting over the loss of a friend. His first term as president would go down as one of the most brilliantly successful in American history, capped off by the Louisiana Purchase, 1803, which effectively doubled the size of the national domain. His second term, on the other hand, proved to be a series of domestic tribulations and foreign policy failures, capped off by the infamous Embargo Act, 1807, which devastated the economy while failing to avert the looming war with England. Adams' assessment of Jefferson's presidency mixed fair-minded criticism of his policies with prejudicial comments on his character. Mr. Jefferson has reason to reflect upon himself. How he will get rid of his remorse in retirement, I know not. He must know that he leaves the government infinitely worse than he found it, and that from his own error or ignorance. I wish his telescopes and mathematical instruments, however, may secure his felicity. But if I have not mismeasured his ambition, the sword will cut away the scabbard. I have no resentment against him, although he has honored and salaried almost every villain he could find who had been an enemy to me. Despite his brave posturings of nonchalance and indifference, Adams was in fact obsessed with Jefferson's growing reputation as one of the major figures of the age. As Adams remembered it, Jefferson had played a decidedly minor role in the Continental Congress, while he, John Adams, was delivering the fiery speeches that eventually moved their reluctant colleagues to make the decisive break with England, Jefferson lingered in the background like a shy schoolboy, so subdued that, during the whole time I sat with him in Congress, I never heard him utter three sentences together. Now, however, because of the annual celebrations on July 4th, the symbolic significance of the Declaration of Independence was looming larger in the public memory, blotting out the messier but more historically correct version of the story, transforming Jefferson from a secondary character to a star player in the drama. Was there ever a coup de théâtre, Adams complained, that had so great an effect as Jefferson's penmanship of the Declaration of Independence? Jefferson was an elegant stylist, to be sure, which was one of the main reasons that he, John Adams, had selected him to draft the famous document in the first place. But he was not a mover and shaker, only a draftsman. The words he wrote were merely the lyrical expression of ideas that had been bandied about in the Congress and the various colonial legislatures for years. Adams had actually led the debate in the Congress that produced its passage, as Jefferson sat silently and sullenly while the delegates revised his language. What was really just a theatrical sideshow was now being enshrined in memory as the defining moment in the revolutionary drama. Jefferson ran away with the stage effect, Adams lamented, and all the glory of it. Adams was not the kind of man to suffer in silence. His jealousy of Jefferson was palpable, and his throbbing vanity became patently obvious as he relived the contested moments from the past in the privacy of his own memory, then reported on his admittedly self-serving findings to trusted confidants like Benjamin Rush. For the simple truth was that the aging sage of Quincy had nothing else to do. Jefferson had the all-consuming duties of the presidency, then two major retirement projects, the completion of his architectural renovations of Monticello and the creation of the University of Virginia. But the sole project for Adams lay within himself. His focus Indeed, his obsession was the interior architecture of his own remembrances, the construction of an Adams version of American history, a spacious room of his own within the American pantheon. He was doing what we would now call therapy, threshing about inside himself in endless debate with his internal demons while seated by the fireside in what he self-mockingly called my throne, twitching in and out of control as he attempted to compose his autobiography, which turned into a series of salvos at his political enemies. Hamilton, no surprise, was the chief target, and ended literally in mid-sentence when he realized that it was all catharsis and no coherence. Outraging his old friend Mercy Otis Warren with embarrassing tantrums because her three-volume History of the American Revolution, 1805, failed to make him the major player in the story. Warren responded in kind. "I am so much at a loss for the meaning of your paragraphs and the rambling manner in which your angry and undigested letters are written," she explained, "that I scarcely know where to begin my remarks." Warren concluded with a scathing diagnosis of the Adams correspondence with her as a scattered series of verbal impulses and the most captious, malignant, irrelevant compositions that have ever been seen. Undeterred, he launched another round of his memoirs in the Boston Patriot, designed to set the record straight, an act that quickly gave rise to another cascade of emotional eruptions. "Let the jackasses bray or laugh at this," he declared defiantly. "I am in a fair way to give my critics and enemies food enough to glut their appetites. I take no notice of their Billingsgate." While drafting the nearly interminable essays for the Patriot, he compared himself to a wild animal who had grabbed the end of a cord with his teeth and was drawn slowly up by pulleys through a storm of squills, crackers, and rockets flashing and blazing around him every moment. And although the scorching flames made him groan and mourn and roar, he would not let go. He was, to put it bluntly, driving himself half crazy in frantic but futile attempts at self-vindication. Every effort to redeem his reputation only confirmed what Hamilton had claimed in his infamous pamphlet during the presidential campaign of 1800, namely, that Adams was an inherently erratic character who often lacked control over his own emotional impulses. In 1805, Adams resumed a correspondence with Benjamin Rush, in which he actually seemed to embrace that very conclusion. "There have been many times in my life when I have been so agitated in my own mind," Adams confessed, "as to have no consideration at all of the light in which my words, actions, and even writings would be considered by others. The few traces that remain of me must, I believe, go down to posterity in much confusion and distraction as my life has been passed." The correspondence with Rush, which lasted for 8 years, permitted Adams to confront his personal demons and exorcise them in a series of remarkable exchanges that, taken together, are the most colorful, playful, and revealing letters he ever wrote. Rush set the terms for what became a high-stakes game of honesty by proposing that they dispense with the usual topics and report to each other on their respective dreams. Adams leapt at the suggestion and declared himself prepared to match his old friend, dream for dream. Rush began with a singular dream set in 1790, and focusing on a crazed derelict who was promising a crowd that he could produce rain and sunshine and cause the wind to blow from any quarter he pleased. Rush interpreted this eloquent lunatic as a symbolic figure representing all those political leaders in the infant nation who claimed they could shape public opinion. Adams subsequently countered, I dreamed that I was mounted on a lofty scaffold in the center of a great plain in Versailles, surrounded by an innumerable congregation of 25 millions. But the crowd was not comprised of people. Instead, they were all inhabitants of the royal menagerie, including lions, elephants, wildcats, rats, squirrels, whales, sharks. The litany went on for several paragraphs, who then proceeded to tear one another to pieces as he tried to lecture them on the advantages of the unadulterated principles of liberty, equality, and fraternity among all living creatures. At the end of the dream, he was forced to flee the scene with my clothes torn from my back and my skin lacerated from head to foot. As befits a dialogue framed around reports from the subconscious regions, the Adams-Rush correspondence tended to emphasize the power of the irrational. Adams recalled a French barber in Boston who used the phrase, a little crack, meaning slightly crazy. I have long thought the philosophers of the 18th century and almost all men of science and letters crack, and that the sun, moon, and stars send all their lunatics here for confinement. Then, ever playful with Rush, Adams signed off with the following self-deprecating joke. I must tell you that my wife, who took a fancy to read this letter upon my table, bids me tell you that she thinks my head, too, a little crack, and I am half of that mind myself. Adams had a lifelong tendency to view the world out there as a projection of the emotions he felt swirling inside himself. The overriding honesty and intimacy of the correspondence with Rush permitted this projection to express itself without restraint. The question he had posed to others, simultaneously poignant and pathetic, had the authentic ring of a cri de coeur. How is it that I, poor, ignorant I, must stand before posterity as differing from all the other great men of the age? In his monthly exchanges with Rush, Adams worked out his answer to that question. There is a Mad Hatter character to the Adams-Rush correspondence, as both men swapped stories and shared anecdotes in a kind of Adams and Rush in Wonderland mode. But there was a deadly serious insight buried within the comedy. The insight was precocious, anticipating, as it did, the distinction between history as experienced and history as remembered, most famously depicted in Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace. The core insight that all seamless historical narratives are latter-day constructions lies at the center of all postmodern critiques of traditional historical explanations. Under Rush's prodding influence and in response to his dreamy inspirations, Adams realized that the act of transforming the American Revolution into history placed a premium on selecting events and heroes that fit neatly into a dramatic formula, thereby distorting the more tangled and incoherent experience that participants actually making the history felt at the time. Jefferson's drafting of the Declaration of Independence was a perfect example of such dramatic distortions. The revolution in this romantic rendering became one magical moment of inspiration, leading inexorably to the foregone conclusion of American independence. As Adams remembered it, on the other hand, all the great critical questions about men and measures from 1774 to 1778 were desperately contested in highly problematic occasions, usually decided by the vote of a single state, and that vote was often decided by a single individual. Nothing was clear, inevitable, or even comprehensible to the soldiers in the field at Saratoga or the statesmen in the corridors at Philadelphia. It was patched and piebald policy then as it is now, ever was, and ever will be, world without end. the real drama of the American Revolution, which was perfectly in accord with Adams's memory as well as with the turbulent conditions of his own soul, was its inherent messiness. This meant recovering the exciting but terrifying sense that all the major players had at the time, namely that they were making it up as they went along, improvising on the edge of catastrophe. Adams derived his authority for a deconstructed version of the American Revolution from his incontestable claim to have been present at the creation. He had been a participant during most, if not all, of the crucial moments, from the Stamp Act crisis in 1765 to his own retirement from the presidency in 1801, and he knew all the major players personally. This conferred instant credibility upon his preferred role as designated truth-teller, poised to expose the chaotic reality beneath all uplifting accounts of the Revolution. Support for American independence, for example, was always fragile and shifted with each victory or defeat in the field, which was often a matter of pure luck. Or the decision to locate the national capital on the Potomac was a backroom deal, involving so many secret bargains and bribes that no one would ever unravel the full story. In the same vein, all the heroic portraits of the great men were romanticized distortions. Franklin, for example, was a superb scientist and masterful prose stylist, to be sure, but also a vacuous political thinker and diplomatic fraud who spent the bulk of his time in Paris flirting with younger women of the salon set. Washington was an indisputable American patriarch, but more an actor than a leader, brilliant at striking poses in a strain of Shakespearean excellence at dramatic exhibitions. He was also poorly read, seldom wrote his own speeches, and, according to one member of his cabinet, could not write a sentence without misspelling some word. In general, the Virginians were the chief beneficiaries of all the highly stylized histories, though, as Adams observed, not a lad upon the highlands is more clannish than every Virginian I have ever known. Virginians were also the most adept at employing what Adams called puffers, what we would call spinners or public relations experts. "These puffers, Rush, are the only killers of scandal," Adams noted. "You and I have never employed them, and therefore scandal has prevailed against us." When Rush somewhat mischievously suggested that Adams himself enjoyed the support of Federalist puffers, specifically mentioning William Cobbett, Adams pleaded total ignorance. "Now, I assure you upon my honor and the faith of the friendship between us that I never saw the face of Cobbett, and that I should not know him if I met him in my porridge dish." This last remark, while vintage Adams-Rush banter, also exposed the painfully egotistical motives lurking beneath the entire Adams campaign for a more realistic, non-mythologized version of the American Revolution. While his insistence on a deconstructed history was certainly a precocious intellectual insight, there is also no question that the Adams urge to discredit the dramatic renderings of the Revolutionary era was driven by his own wounded vanity. To put it squarely, such versions of the story failed to provide him with a starring role in the drama. At its nub, his critique of the historical fictions circulating as seductive truths was much like a campaign to smash all the statues because the sculptor had failed to render a satisfactory likeness of yours truly. On the other hand, Adams possessed a congenital affinity for deconstructed interpretations of history, of his own life, indeed of practically everything. It was the way he saw the world. By temperament, he was inherently impulsive, highly combustible, instinctively irreverent. All his major published works on political philosophy, including his defense of the Constitution of the United States of America and discourses on Davila, along with his unpublished autobiography, lacked coherent form. They were less books than notebooks, filled with rambling transcriptions of his own internal conversations that ricocheted off one another at unpredictable angles. While his most devoted enemies, chiefly Franklin and Hamilton, claimed that his erratic habits of mind were symptomatic of mental illness, some recent scholarship has suggested the problem was physical, that he might well have been afflicted with hyperthyroidism or Graves' disease. For our purposes, however, the ultimate cause of the condition is less important than its systemic manifestation, which was a congenital inability to separate his thoughts from his feelings about them. This caused him to mistrust all purely rational descriptions of human behavior as incompatible with the more passionate stirrings he felt within his own personality. As he told Rush, "Deceive not thyself. There is not an old friar in France, not in Europe, who looks on a blooming young virgin with sang-froid." These same internal stirrings also predisposed him to regard all perfectly symmetrical narratives or stories preaching an obvious moral message and populated by larger-than-life heroes as utter fabrications. Like straight lines in nature, such things did not exist for him. They did, however, for his former friend at Monticello, who had spent the bulk of his adult life keeping his head and his heart in separate chambers of his personality. Starting in 1807, Jefferson's name began to come up sporadically in Adams's letters to Rush. Prior to that time, Jefferson had remained a forbidden subject. When asked to comment on his renowned partnership with Jefferson during the early days of the American Revolution, Adams developed a standard statement of denial. "You are much mistaken when you say that no man living have so much knowledge of Mr. Jefferson's transactions as myself," Adams insisted. "I know but little concerning him." With Rush, however, Adams began to slip Jefferson into their conversation as an example of the kind of enigmatic temperament destined to flourish in the history books. He recalled Jefferson's retirement from the Washington administration in 1793, quite obviously a shrewd tactical retreat designed to position Jefferson for his ascent toward the summit of the pyramid, that is, the presidency, but which was described by the Republican press as unambitious, unavaricious, and perfectly disinterested. Somehow, Jefferson was even able to persuade himself that he was beyond temptation and happily ensconced on his mountaintop for the duration. When a man has one of the two greatest parties in a nation interested in representing him, to be disinterested, Adams observed with amazement, even those who believe it to be a lie will repeat it so often to one another that at last they will seem to believe it to be true. The same pattern materialized later in the 1790s when Jefferson embraced two misguided propositions about European affairs. The first was that England was tottering to her fall, that her economy was collapsing, and she must soon be a bankrupt and unable to maintain her naval superiority. The second misguided opinion, still more erroneous and still more fatal, was that France was the wave of the future, that she would establish a free republican government and even a leveling democracy, and that monarchy and nobility would forever be abolished in France, all of which would occur peacefully and bloodlessly. In both instances, events proved Jefferson wrong. In both instances, Adams had disagreed with Jefferson and been proven right. But despite his underestimation of England and his overestimation of France, Jefferson's reputation and popularity soared. "I have reason to remember it," Adams recalled, "because my opinion of the French Revolution produced a coldness toward me in all my revolutionary friends, and an inclination toward Mr. Jefferson, which broke out in violent invectives and false imputations upon me and in flattering panegyrics upon Mr. Jefferson. Once again, Jefferson seemed uniquely equipped to become the chief beneficiary of romanticized versions of history, in part because his own capacity for self-deception permitted him to deny, and with utter sincerity, the vanities and ambitions lurking in his own soul, and in part because the moralistic categories that shaped all his political thinking fit perfectly the romantic formula that history writing seemed to require. The fact that these categories were blatant illusions, for example, the French Revolution was not a European version of the American Revolution, seemed to matter less than the fact that they confirmed a potent and seductive mythology that was more appealing than the messier reality. Through some complex combination of duplicity and disposition, Jefferson had come to embody the will to believe. He was not so much living a lie as living a fiction that he had come to believe himself. Adams had come to see himself as the mirror image of Jefferson. "Mausoleums, statues, monuments will never be erected to me," he wrote with resignation to Rush. "Panegyrical romances will never be written, nor flattering orations spoken to transmit me to posterity in brilliant colors. No, nor in true colors. All but the last I loathe." Facing that unattractive truth took time, a full decade of shouting and pouting, relieved by converting his despair into comedy with Rush. But it also came naturally to Adams, whose entire career had been spent preaching the unattractive truths to everybody else. If Jefferson seemed predestined to tell people what they wanted to hear, Adams now acknowledged that his own destiny was just the opposite, to tell them what they needed to know. This was Adams's resigned but bittersweet mood in 1809, when Rush reported his most amazing dream yet. He dreamed that Adams had written a short letter to Jefferson, congratulating him on his recent retirement from public life. Jefferson had then responded to this magnanimous gesture with equivalent graciousness. The two great patriarchs had then engaged in a correspondence over several years in which they candidly acknowledged their mutual mistakes, shared their profound reflections on the meaning of American independence, and recovered their famous friendship. Then the two philosopher kings sunk into the grave nearly at the same time, full of years and rich in the gratitude and praises of their country. And to their numerous merits and honors, posterity has added that they were rival friends. Adams responded immediately, "A dream again. I have no other objection to your dream but that it is not history. It may be prophecy." Then he offered a satirical account of his relationship with Jefferson, claiming that there has never been the smallest interruption of the personal friendship between Mr. Jefferson that I know of. This convenient lie was then followed by a humorous piece of bravado. "You should remember that Jefferson was but a boy to me. I was at least 10 years older than him in age, and more than 20 years older in politics. I am bold to say I was his preceptor in politics, and taught him everything that was good and solid in his whole political conduct." How could one hold a grudge against a disciple? On the other hand, given Jefferson's junior status, was it not more appropriate for him to initiate the reconciliation? "If I should receive a letter from him," Adams concluded tartly, "I should not fail to acknowledge and answer it." Jefferson, in short, would have to extend the hand first. That was not going to happen. Rush was simultaneously writing Jefferson, somewhat misleadingly suggesting that Adams had indicated he was now eager for a reconciliation and virtually on his deathbed. I am sure an advance on your side will be a cordial to the heart of Mr. Adams," Rush explained. Tottering over the grave, he now leans wholly upon the shoulders of his old revolutionary friends. But Jefferson would not rise to the bait, convinced as he was after his early exchange with Abigail that he had already made a heroic effort that had been summarily rejected. It was now Adams's turn to attempt a bridging of the gap. That was how it stood for more than two ensuing years, the two sages circling each other, marking off their territory like old dogs, sniffing around the edges of a possible reconciliation, reluctant to close the distance. The distance was reduced in 1811, when Edward Coles, a Jefferson protégé who was attempting in vain, it turned out, to persuade his mentor to assume a more forthright position opposing slavery, visited Adams in Quincy. Adams let it be known that his political disagreements with Jefferson had never killed his affection for the man. "I always loved Jefferson," he told Coles, "and still love him." When word of this exchange reached Jefferson, as Adams knew it would, Jefferson declared his conversion. "This is enough for me," he wrote Rush, adding that he knew Adams to be always an honest man, often a great one, but sometimes incorrect and precipitate in his judgments. This latter caveat re-widened the gap that the earlier statement had seemed to close. The gap became a chasm when Jefferson went on to explain that he had always valued Adams's judgment, with the single exception as to his political opinions, a statement roughly equivalent to claiming that the Pope was otherwise infallible, except when he declared himself on matters of faith and morals. On Christmas Day of 1811, Adams apprised Rush that he was fully aware of the benevolent duplicities Rush was performing as intermediary. "I perceive plainly, Rush, that you have been teasing Jefferson to write me as you did me to write him." Adams also knew full well that Rush was sending edited versions of his letters to Jefferson, removing the potentially offensive passages. In the Christmas letter, Adams reviewed the full range of political disagreements with Jefferson, mixing together serious controversies, for example the Alien and Sedition Acts, the French Revolution, the American Navy, with a light-hearted list of personal differences. For example, Adams held levees once a week as president, while Jefferson's entire presidency was a levee. Jefferson thought liberty favored straight hair, while Adams thought curled hair just as republican as straight. That was the tone Adams wanted to convey to Jefferson, still feisty and critical of Jefferson's principles and policies, but fully capable of controlling the dialogue with humor and diplomatic nonchalance. The fires still burned, but the great volcano of the revolutionary generation was at last in remission. In the end, it was Adams who made the decisive move. On January 1, 1812, a short but cordial note went out from Quincy to Monticello, relaying family news and referring to two pieces of homespun coming along by separate packet. Rush was ecstatic, as well as fully convinced that he had orchestrated a reconciliation. "I rejoice in the correspondence which has taken place between you and your old friend, Mr. Jefferson," he declared triumphantly to Adams. "I consider you and him as the North and South Poles of the American Revolution. Some talked, some wrote, and some fought to promote and establish it, but you and Mr. Jefferson fought for us all." Adams went along with the celebratory mood, hiding his pride behind a mask of jokes and the rather fraudulent pretense that his famous friendship with Jefferson had never really been interrupted. "Your dream is out, your prophecy fulfilled. You have worked wonders. You have made peace between powers that were never at enmity. In short, the mighty defunct potentates of Mount Wollaston and Monticello, by your sorceries, are again in being. In the same self-consciously jocular style, he soon began to refer to his Quincy estate as Montezillo, which he claimed meant very little mountain, in deference to Jefferson's Monticello, which meant little mountain. He insisted that Rush was making more of the reunion with Jefferson than it deserved. Nothing momentous or historic was at stake. It was only as if one sailor had met a brother sailor after 25 years' absence, Adams joked, and had accosted him, "How fare you, Jack?" Nothing could have been further from the truth. Adams's ever-vibrating vanities were now true enough under some measure of control, but his dismissive posture toward the rupture in the friendship, what breach and what betrayal, was obviously only a bravado pose. Even the start of the correspondence exposed the awkward tensions just below the surface. Jefferson presumed quite plausibly that the 2 pieces of homespun Adams was sending along referred to domestically produced clothing, a nice symbol of the American economic response to the embargo, and a fitting reminder of the good old days when Adams and Jefferson had first joined the movement for American independence. And so Jefferson responded with a lengthy treatise on the merits of domestic manufacturing and grand memories of the non-importation movement in the 1760s, only to discover that Adams had intended the homespun reference as a metaphor. His gift turned out to be a copy of John Quincy's recent 2-volume work, Lectures on Rhetoric and Oratory. Why, then, did Adams take the fateful step which led to a 14-year exchange of 158 letters, a correspondence that is generally regarded as the intellectual capstone to the achievements of the revolutionary generation and the most impressive correspondence between prominent statesmen in all of American history? The friendship and the mutual trust on which it rested had, in fact, not been recovered by 1812. It took the correspondence to recover the friendship, not the other way around. What then motivated Adams to extend his hand across the gap that existed between Quincy and Monticello, then write more than 2 letters for every one of Jefferson's? 2 overlapping but competing answers come to mind. First, there was a good deal of unfinished business between the 2 men, a clear recognition on both sides that they had come to fundamentally different conclusions about what the American Revolution meant. Adams believed that Jefferson's version of the story, while misguided, was destined to dominate the history books. The resumption of his correspondence with Jefferson afforded Adams the opportunity to challenge the Jeffersonian version, and to do so in the form of a written record virtually certain to become a major historical document of its own. "You and I ought not to die," Adams rather poignantly put it in an earlier letter, "before we have explained ourselves to each other." But both men knew they were sending their letters to posterity as much as to each other. Second, the reconciliation and ensuing correspondence permitted Adams to join Jefferson as the co-star of an artfully arranged final act in the revolutionary drama. Adams had spent most of his retirement years denouncing such contrivances as gross distortions of history, but he had also spent those same years marveling at the benefits that accrued to anyone willing to pose for posterity in the mythical mode. If he could only control himself, if he could speak the lines that history wanted to hear, if he could fit himself into the heroic mold like a kind of living statue, he might yet win his ticket to immortality. Both Adams and Jefferson knew their roles by heart, especially in its Ciceronian version, as a pair of retired patriarchs now beyond ambition and above controversy. The dialogue they sustained from 1812 to 1826 can be read at several levels, but the chief source of its modern appeal derives from its elegiac tone. the image of two American icons looking back with seasoned serenity at the revolution they have wrought, delivering eloquent soliloquies on all the timeless topics, speaking across their political differences to each other and across the ages to us. If we wished to conjure up a mental picture of this rendition of the dialogue, it would feature Jefferson standing tall and straight in his familiar statuesque posture, his arms folded across his chest as was his custom, while the much shorter Adams paced back and forth around him, jabbing at the air in his nervous and animated style, periodically stopping to grab Jefferson by the lapels to make an irreverent point. This, of course, is the constructed or posed version that ought to provoke our immediate skepticism. In Adams's terms, this is not history, but romance. For several reasons, however, this beguiling depiction cannot be summarily dismissed. First of all, the friendship was in fact recovered and the reconciliation realized during the course of the correspondence. The clinching evidence comes late, in 1823, when Jefferson responded to a series of letters that appeared in the newspapers. Adams had written them much earlier and had described Jefferson as a duplicitous political partisan. "Be assured, my dear sir," Jefferson wrote Adams, "that I am incapable of receiving the slightest impression from the effort now made to plant thorns on the pillow of age, worth, and wisdom, and to sow tares between friends who have been such for nearly half a century. Beseeching you, then, not to suffer your mind to be disquieted by this wicked attempt to poison its peace, and praying you to throw it by." Adams was overjoyed. He insisted that Jefferson's letter be read aloud to his entire extended family at the breakfast table, calling it "the best letter that ever was written, just such a letter as I expected, only it was infinitely better expressed." He concluded with an Adams salvo against the peevish and fretful effusions of politicians, then signed off as J.A. in the 89 year of his age, still too fat to last much longer. Clearly, this was no dramatic contrivance. The old trust had been fully recovered. Second, the improbably symmetrical ending to the dialogue casts an irresistibly dramatic spell over the entire story and the way to tell it. Rush had predicted that the two patriarchs would reconcile, then go to their graves at nearly the same time. But their mutual exit was even more exquisitely timed than Rush had dreamed. No serious novelist would ever dare to make this up. They died within 5 hours of each other, on the 50th anniversary to the day, and almost to the hour of the official announcement of American independence to the world in 1776. Call it a miracle, an accident, or a case of two powerful personalities willing themselves to expire on schedule and according to script. But it happened. Third, the correspondence can be read as an extended conversation between two gods on Mount Olympus, because both men were determined to project that impression. "But whither is senile garrulity leading me?" Jefferson asked rhetorically. "Into politics, of which I have taken final leave? I have given up newspapers in exchange for Tacitus and Thucydides, for Newton and Euclid, and I find myself much happier." Adams then responded with his own display of classical learning and literary flair. "I have read Thucydides and Tacitus so often and at such distant periods of my life that, elegant, profound, and enchanting is their style, I am weary of them. Then joked that my senectutal loquacity has more than retaliated your senile garrulity." Many of the most memorable exchanges required no staging or self-conscious posing whatsoever. since there was a host of safe subjects the two sages could engage without risking conflict and that afforded occasions for conspicuous displays of their verbal prowess. They were, after all, two of the most accomplished letter writers of the era, men who had fashioned over long careers at the writing desk distinctive prose styles that expressed their different personalities perfectly. Thus, Jefferson waxed eloquent on the aging process and their mutual intimations of mortality. "But our machines have now been running for 70 or 80 years," he observed stoically, "and we must expect that, worn as they are, here a pivot, there a wheel, now a pinion, next a spring, will be giving way, and however we may tinker with them for a while, all will at length surcease motion." Adams responded in kind, but with a caveat. "I am sometimes afraid that my machine will not surcease motion soon enough, for I dread nothing so much as dying at the top," meaning becoming senile and a burden to his family. He then went on to chide Jefferson for talking like an old man. "Of all the original signers of the Declaration of Independence, you are the youngest and the most energetic in mind and body, and therefore most likely to be the final survivor. Like the last person in the household to retire for the night, it would be Jefferson's responsibility to close up the fireplace and rake the ashes over the coals." Most modern readers come to the correspondence fully aware of Jefferson's proficiency with a pen, and are therefore somewhat surprised to discover that Adams could more than hold his own in the verbal dueling, indeed delivered the most quotable lines. For example, after Jefferson produced a lengthy exegesis on the origins of the Native American population of North America, Adams dismissed all the current theories about the original occupants of the continent. "I should as soon suppose that the prodigal son, in a frolic with one of his girls, made a trip to America in one of Mother Carey's eggshells and left the fruit of their amours here." Or when Jefferson embraced the development of an indigenous American language, arguing that everyday usage is the workshop in which new ones, words, are elaborated, rather than the English dictionaries compiled by the likes of Samuel Johnson, Adams went into a colorful tirade. "All English dictionaries," he declared, "were vestiges of the same British tyranny that the American Revolution destroyed forever." "We are no more bound by Johnson's dictionary," he pronounced, "than by the canon law of England." By what right did Samuel Johnson deny him, John Adams, the freedom to fashion his own vocabulary? "I have as good a right to make a word," he insisted, "as that pedant, bigot, cynic, and monk." Speaking of words, the pungency of the Adams prose comes through so impressively in the correspondence, in part because Adams invested himself in the exchange more than Jefferson. He composed more memorable passages because he wrote many more words. When the torrent from Quincy threatened to flood Monticello, he apologized for getting so far out ahead. Jefferson then apologized in return, claiming that he received over 1,200 letters a year, all of which required responses, so it was difficult for him to match the Adams pace. Adams replied that he received only a fraction of that number, but chose not to answer most of them, which allowed him to focus all his allegedly waning energies on Jefferson. Beyond sheer verbal volume, the punch so evident in the Adams prose reflected his more aggressive and confrontational temperament. The Jefferson style was fluid, lyrical, cadenced, and melodious. Words for him were like calming breezes that floated across the pages. The Adams style was excited, jumpy, exclamatory, naughty. Words for him were like weapons designed to pierce the pages or explode above them in illuminating airbursts. While the Adams style generated a host of memorable epigrammatic flashes, it was the worst possible vehicle for sustaining the diplomatic niceties. Jefferson was perfectly capable of remaining on script and in role as philosopher king to the end. If it had been up to him, the demigod version of the Adams-Jefferson dialogue would have captured its essence and ultimate meaning as a staged performance for posterity. Adams, however, despite all his vows of Ciceronian serenity, was congenitally incapable of staying in character. For him, the only meaningful kind of conversation was an argument, and that, in the end, is what the dialogue with Jefferson became, and the best way to understand its historical significance. Adams remained on his best behavior for over a year. There were a few brief flurries, chiefly jabs at Jefferson's failure to prepare the nation for the War of 1812, especially his negligence in building up the American Navy, which had always been an Adams hobby horse. Ever diplomatic, Jefferson never quite conceded that Adams had been right about a larger navy, but when the American fleet won some early battles in the war, Jefferson graciously noted that the success of our little navy must be more gratifying to you than to most men, as having been the early and constant advocate of wooden walls. The potentially explosive issues lay buried further back in the past. Both men recognized that touching them placed the newly established reconciliation at risk. The first Adams eruption occurred in June of 1813, followed immediately by a chain reaction of explosions over the ensuing 6 months. Adams wrote 30 letters, Jefferson 5. The detonating device was publication of a letter Jefferson had written in 1801 to Joseph Priestley, the English scientist and renowned critic of Christianity. In that letter, Jefferson had mentioned Adams in passing as a retrograde thinker opposed to all forms of progress, one of the ancients rather than moderns. "The sentiment that you have attributed to me in your letter to Dr. Priestley, I totally disclaim," Adams protested, "and I demand, in the French sense of the word, demand of you the proof." Sensing that Adams was in mid-explosion, Jefferson responded at length. The Priestley letter was a confidential communication that was never meant to trouble the public mind. He then went on to remind Adams that the party wars were still raging back then, that both sides had been guilty of some rather extreme denunciations of the others, and that his real target had been the Federalists, who had defamed his own notions of government as dangerous innovations. Then came the crucial acknowledgment and quasi-apology. Adams had been targeted for criticism because he